Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Anatomy, Bio 231. I always announce that so it's on the recorder. I haven't built the webpage for these lectures, but I will probably over the weekend, and I'll start uploading these WAV files. So if you want to listen to lecture again, you're welcome to do that. And some people got ad codes, haven't logged into Blackboard just yet, and I have a syllabus. If you want a hard copy of a syllabus, all right, you certainly are welcome to have that. You can get it online, but I just have a hard copy. If anybody would want a hard copy of syllabus, raise your hand and I'll pass. Oh, a bunch of people. Nice.
Thank you.
Okay. Pass these up that way. I have 20, which is not a whole lot. Okay. Pass these around. If not, if you don't get one, just pass them straight back that way. And around a little bit. I'll hand these to you since you're kind of off to the side a little bit. Pass one back. Okay, so everybody's welcome to have a hard copy. I didn't know there would be so much interest in a hard copy. Oh, good. Good, good, good. Especially people that have gotten ad codes. Remember, ad coders, you definitely have to register. It won't happen automatically, even though you're on the wait list. Some colleges, an instructor can just click a button and register you if you're on the wait list, but not here. All right. So on the right-hand side, let's take a look at the schedule. How are we doing? We're not really behind, I don't think, very much. Woo-hoo, that's great. So today is the... I have 2013. That's not really helpful. But nonetheless, I don't even want to take time to get it because we're right at the beginning of the class. All right, so we are going to get into cells today, and then next week, tissues. And I think it's really important for you to do those pre-lecture reading assignments. And today's date, in case anybody's concerned, is the 28th. Okay, you should put a 28 right there. I'm sure it is on your paper. Do the pre-lecture reading assignments, and it would be really nice if you showed me one or two sometime. Not in a lot of detail. We don't have to discuss every one, but I'd like to see how you're doing with those. And the answer key for the first lecture should have popped open for you to look at. Anybody look at the answer key for the first assignment? Was it really there? Oh, wow, that's nice. Okay, I meant it to be there. It's nice when something like that happens. Okay. All right, well, I'll put this schedule away. So your first exam is still a little ways off. I'm pretty sure we almost finished chapter one, but not quite. I want to go over these body cavities one more time, but I'm going to turn the microphone down a little bit, like that. Can you hear me in the back still, pretty much? Okay, body cavities, labeled. All right, let's just look at these for fun. Let's talk about imaging planes, or planes that define the body. Which one is this? Okay, well, how many choices do you have? You got three choices, and what would you choose here? Don't look at how it's labeled. Okay, it is frontal. What's another name for frontal? Yeah, coronal. I might use coronal more often because I grew up talking that language instead of frontal, but either one is possible. Okay, and what about this one here? Transverse, sometimes called a cross section, and then finally, that's a sagittal. You guys won't be able to tell, but this is right smack in the middle of somebody's body, right smack in the middle. It is sagittal, but a special case of sagittal because it's right smack in the middle. Right down the nasal septum between your two front teeth, right through the middle of your belly button. That is called a mid-sagittal, right? And we use that terminology sometimes. If it's a sagittal section off to either side, off of mid-sagittal, sometimes we call that parasagittal. But then again, usually I just say sagittal. Okay. All right, so what plane is this? What's this? You got it? Okay. I should make a video of that. So if you guys can keep up, that would be fantastic. All right, some body cavities. Let's just use this slide right here. Okay, so your body can kind of be divided into two places. Something that we call the body. Right, this is kind of nebulous terminology. Another name for body is soma, And your body is really all these hard pieces that you look at, muscles and bones, right? That's the somatic part of your body. And that's the part that's usually under voluntary control. You can control those things. We call it somatic control. Then there's another place that's made out of cavities, right? And here we see a bunch of cavities. That's not somatic, right? That's visceral, because it has these visceral organs. These things you cannot control, right? They're controlled automatically, which we call autonomic. They're controlled with the autonomic nervous system. So, well, before we start learning about the organs that are in these places, we want to at least know what the cavities are. And we can group them into two general categories. The ones in the back. I see two that are in the back. What's another name for back? An anatomical term. Dorsal. I like dorsal. There's even another name. Posterior. Posterior and dorsal are the same for us. So here's the dorsal cavity, but the dorsal cavity is made up of two other cavities, namely the cranial and the vertebral. And the cranial cavity contains the brain. Vertebral cavity contains the spinal cord. We see some bones around the spinal cord. That's what we call the vertebral column. Since that's the vertebral column, that's how come this cavity right here got named the vertebral cavity. And those vertebrae just make up some nice armor plating that protect the spinal cord. And then there's some armor plating up over here, right, that protects the brain, makes this cavity. All right, so that's the dorsal. Then we have ventral cavity. Ventral cavity has a lot of cavities. And remember, there can be cavities inside of cavities, just like we saw over here. The most superior one, you should know what superior is right now. Everybody know what superior means? Yeah, above when you're in anatomic position. Yeah, you can't be upside down or lying down. You have to be in anatomic position, then superior makes sense. So here's the most superior one. That's the thoracic cavity. Contains some really important vital organs, lungs, heart, vessels that come on and off the heart. Those are vital organs as well. Thymus gland is in there. So that's thoracic cavity. Right at the inferior margin of the thoracic cavity is a big strong muscle, the diaphragm. And that's kind of a funny muscle because it's in this visceral part of your body, but it's still under voluntary control. You can hold your breath, right, if you want to. But most of the time, it's just kind of taking care of itself. You don't have to think about taking every breath. Does anybody in here have to think about breathing before they breathe, like moving their arm? That happens to some people, and as you can imagine, it's a pain because you can't sleep unless you're on a respirator. It has to take over. That's called Odin's curse, right? So diaphragm is functioning. And then right underneath the diaphragm, just inferior to the diaphragm, there's another cavity that contains visceral organs that you have no control over whatsoever. That is your abdominal cavity. And then even inferior to that is another cavity that contains part of the urinary system and reproductive system organs, and even the digestive system pokes down in there a little bit. That is the pelvic cavity, and there is nothing that separates abdominal from pelvic cavity. There's a little line right here that kind of shows you the distinction between where the abdominal cavity would stop and the pelvic cavity would begin, but that's just put there by the artist for your appreciation for about where that would be. There's nice landmarks on your hip bones to define where the pelvic cavity is, and I think the artist kind of drew that in knowing where the hip bones would be. So that's it. Oh, but if we put thoracic cavity together with abdominal and pelvic cavity, what do we get? The ventral cavity. Yep, ventral cavity as opposed to dorsal cavity over here. All right, so that is the drawing on your quiz this week. We didn't have time in the first lab, I think on Monday. Was it the Monday 8 o'clock group? Didn't have time. We'll do that sometime next Monday. Okay, so that you don't get gypped out of those points. Okay. All right, well, let's look at a nice coronal section through this person's body, and now we can see some more cavities that are inside cavities. For sure, we can see the dorsal, so here's cranial, here's vertebral. That's all of the dorsal cavity that we can see because it is behind, right? It's posterior to the ventral body cavities. So here we have the most superior ventral body cavity, which we call thoracic, right? And the lungs are in their special cavity. We call that the pleural cavity. When this thing gets inflamed, we call that pleurisy. Yeah, pleuritis. Pleurisy is the more common term, and inflammation of the lining around the lungs, and the lungs should be moving all the time, expanding, contracting, expanding, contracting. And if somebody has an inflammation of the lining on the lungs, they don't like it. It feels really bad when their lungs expand or when they shrink back down to their normal size. It feels like somebody's stabbing them in the chest. How does that feel? Terrible, right? A lot of severe pain. So what do you have a tendency to do if every time you take a breath, you get stabbed, you have that feeling of being stabbed in the chest? Well, you stop breathing, right? Who wants to breathe and feel that? But what does it feel like when you don't breathe? Anybody ever try that? No? You don't like that, right? I mean, it feels terrible too. So here you have a patient with two choices. Hold their breath and feel terrible, or breathe and feel like somebody's stabbing you in the chest. My goodness. What can you do to help a person like that? Well, for sure you want to fix what's causing that problem, right? Whatever causing that infection, you want to get rid of that. But you sure would like to have a patient that can breathe, and you just alleviate the pain with opiates. That would be a good thing. All right, so that's not drug abuse or anything. If there is a medical sound reason to control somebody's pain, right, don't be adverse to giving them their pain medication. That would be one particular case. All right, so that's the pleural cavity. You see that there are two. There's a right and a left. And there's something separating the pleural cavities. There's a cavity right in the center. And it goes all the way from here to here. Not shown exactly well on this diagram, but it does. It goes all the way to here. Here's the superior margin. Here's the inferior margin. What do we call this? This is a good one. Because if you know this, that means that you've studied anatomy somewhere along the line. This you don't grow up learning about. This is the mediastinum. That's right. Got a little swing to it. Go ahead and say it out loud. Mediastinum. That will help your spelling with it. Sorry, I left these lights on. I'm going to turn some of these off. How's that? Like that? That's good? Much better. Should I turn the other one off? Oh, okay. I can do that. I don't know which switch it is, but it's not that one. It's this one. That's good? That's optimal? Nice. Okay, so that is the mediastinum. It's what separates the pleural cavities from each other. And then there's a cavity inside the mediastinum that holds the heart. That is the pericardial cavity, or pericardial cavity is the best way to talk about that. All right, and then getting out of the thoracic cavity, proceeding past the diaphragm inferiorly, you got the abdominal cavity, and then inferior to that you have the pelvic cavity, like so. Now in anatomy, we can combine anatomical terms if it makes sense to do so. If there is some association between different parts of the anatomy, we might want to talk about them at the exact same time. And as a matter of fact, for instance, if somebody has an appendicitis and that appendix bursts, you get that infectious material all over this region, right, including the pelvic cavity. So we want to talk about this whole region because it has an infection. We don't have to say abdominal cavity plus pelvic cavity, right? We can say, we can just combine those terms together as long as we put an O between them, right? So we could say the abdominopelvic cavity are both of these right here. So that's not abdominal. Right here is the abdominal cavity, but if we put them together, abdomino. You see how I'm saying it a little bit differently? Okay. And there's another name for this cavity that contains the abdominal and pelvic cavity. It's called the peritoneal cavity. Peritoneal. I don't know if it's on this slide someplace, but I can't find it sometimes. Peritoneal cavity. And when you have an inflammation of this cavity right here, it's called a peritonitis. When somebody's appendix bursts, that's a peritonitis. You have an inflammation then of both the abdominal and pelvic cavities. How's that for cavities? Everybody have a pretty good idea of these cavities? You can have cavities inside of cavities. That's probably the most difficult thing. Okay, so that's it for this chapter. Unless there is a question. Who's got a question on this chapter? Anybody have a question? Okay. All right, well, I'll put it away and I'll get our next chapter ready to go. And the next one, oh, look at your schedule. What should the next one be? Cells. Nice. Okay, so here's the text file for cells. And here are the pictures that I want to show you. Cells. All right, so on the right-hand side is an illustration of a cell. It has a lot of organelles, has a lot of stuff inside what we call the plasma membrane. Here's a plasma membrane, or another name for that is cell membrane. It separates the outside world, which is usually dead, from the living world inside the cell. Right? And that living world we call cytoplasm. Cytoplasm is made up of these structures that we call organelles, plus the fluid in between the organelles. That is called cytosol. And if we put organelles together with cytosol, we get cytoplasm. And this is where the living processes take place. So the cell membrane separates the living world from the dead world on the other side and controls what moves in and out of the cell, controls the doorways, when they're open, when they're closed. So this is the basic structure of a cell. Oh, I forgot one thing. Most of you have looked at this structure in lab already underneath a microscope. That's a nucleus. The nucleus contains the blueprint on how to build your body. Right? So we call that genetic material. It can be inherited from one generation to the next, genetic material. All right, so what does a cell have to have by definition? It has to have genetic material. Right? It has to have a cell membrane. And it has to have cytoplasm. If it has those three things, it's a living structure. It's a living thing. If it's missing one of those, then it is not. Right? So I want to just talk about a virus for a second. A virus doesn't have a cell wall. They don't have a plasma membrane. They have a cell wall, which is really hard. It kind of looks more like a plant. Right? And they have genetic material, though. It's not inside the nucleus. They have genetic material, but they don't have cytoplasm. They don't have organelles. So no organelles. Is a virus alive? No, a virus is not a living thing. Right? It can infect you because it has genetic material. It has processes that can inject that genetic material into your cell, and then that genetic material takes over the function of your cells. That's a nasty infection when that happens. All right, so if a virus is not alive, can you kill it? The answer is no, you can't kill something that's not alive. So that's why viral infections are so difficult to treat as opposed to bacterial infections. Bacteria have genetic material, they have cytosol, and they have the cell membrane around them. So it's easier with an antibiotic. Viruses are really tough to control because they're not alive to begin with. All right, so let's look at, I want to talk about this cell, just one more detail. All right, so the living material is inside the plasma membrane. And we are made up of billions of cells, pretty much just like this. Some of our cells don't have all of these features, but some of them do. And that is how our body is put together, with billions of cells. And so the cell is the basic building block of life, right? Because if it has genetic material, cytosol, and plasma membrane, it's a living thing. That is the basic building block of life. And I like to call this thing the structural and functional unit of life. Structural and functional unit of life. So somebody could ask you, what's the structural and functional unit of life? And you would say, the cell. And the reason why I like that concept is because if you understand how a cell operates or how a cell is made, if you understand the anatomy of a cell, which then will help you understand the physiology of the cell, guess what? You know how all life is put together and how it functions, right? So just one cell, if you have a model of that in your mind, you basically know a lot about life, the structural and functional unit of life. And I'll use that concept a lot in this class, the structural and functional unit of something, communication or contraction, that kind of stuff. We'll look at those. All right, so the first organelle that I wish to talk about is the plasma membrane. And it doesn't look like it's very important because it's just a separation, but it's actually more important than that because it controls what enters and leaves the cell. So it controls a lot of things. The cell membrane or plasma membrane. Here is an example of a cell membrane. So we've cut way into the cell. So now we're looking up way over here just in the small region. So we zoom way in. And now I can even see some molecules. So we really zoomed in. Right? This is an artist's illustration. We can't get to this with a compound light microscope that we have in lab, but an artist can draw this out for us. So here's the living world. Here's the dead world out over here. This is what we call the intracellular space that contains cytoplasm. It contains organelles and cytosol. Here's the extracellular. Extracellular means outside the cell. extracellular space, the non-living world. And here is the membrane. Now, when you look at this membrane separating these two different worlds, can you break it up into any layers? Do you see layers at all? Can you mind picture a layer someplace? Do you see layers? And then my next question would be, how many layers do you see? You see two layers. That's good. You're developing like a little eye for anatomy. There are two layers. There is this superficial layer right here, and then here is a second layer down below it. And it just so happens that this compound is a lipid. It's a fatty acid, but it's been modified to contain a phosphorus molecule here. So this is a complicated lipid. It's called a phospholipid, right? Phospholipid. And these down over here are phospholipids as well. And sometimes we would like to think of a membrane with the following description. We like to talk about it as a phospholipid bilayer. And when you say phospholipid bilayer, then you know somebody's talking about a membrane. It could be the cell membrane or a membrane around these organelles. It doesn't matter. They're all going to be what? Phospholipid bilayers. But do you see other things besides phospholipids here? Do you see other kinds of structures? Yeah, I see a lot of different things. I see some proteins. All right, and so this phospholipid bilayer can be modified by placing channels, which are doorways where things can enter or leave the cell. And these channels are controlled by the cell. Sometimes they're open, sometimes they're closed. Other proteins right over here might be enzymes. Enzymes can speed up the rate of a chemical reaction. They can also be antigens. They can have a certain shape so that your body knows that this cell belongs to you. All of these antigens in your body have the same shape, but when we go to another person, then the shape changes a little bit. So just by the anatomy of these molecules on the surface of a cell, your body can tell if it belongs to you or not. Why is that important? Why should your body know if that cell belongs to you or not? Because you really don't want company in there, because that's what we call an infection, right? Might be a bacteria. Viruses have antigens as well. So your body can recognize them by the shape of these things that are pointing into the extracellular space. So enzymes, channels, antigens, and another number of things. I have a list right here for you. Channels, carrier molecules. Sometimes a molecule is too big to move through this little channel. So there's another special one that can actually carry it from one side to the other. Enzymes, I mentioned, structural supports, exchange pumps. Right? There are special little things that require energy that can actually take something that's at a low concentration inside the cell and push it out to the outside. Something won't want to move naturally in that direction, so it requires some energy. When something requires energy, we call that a pump. So say you're out camping someplace and you have some water underground, it just won't automatically flow up. You need to have a pump somewhere to draw it up to where you can drink it. All right, so when we think of a cell membrane, phospholipid bilayer is pretty good, but you see it's much more complicated structure than that. It has all these extra pieces. So a better way of thinking of the plasma membrane is what we call the fluid mosaic model. Fluid because the phospholipid bilayer is very fluid. It just kind of wiggles around, undulates. It's not very strong, right? It's very fluid. If we were to put a membrane in water, it would just float to the surface of water, and when there was a wave on the water, the membrane would just wave just like the water is waving. It wouldn't crack. It's not brittle. It won't fracture because it's very fluid. The mosaic part is what? Then you recognize and understand that there are many more things in the membrane other than the phospholipid. So the fluid part is the phospholipid bilayer, and the mosaic of the fluid mosaic model are all of these proteins. Okay, and there's some additional lipids, and there's some sugar molecules as well. So we talked about proteins. I see some molecules here, here, and here. These are cholesterol molecules. They help reduce the fluidity of this membrane. They make it a little bit more stable because this membrane is so fluid that as soon as you stood up, it would probably just flow right off your body, right? So these cholesterol molecules make the membrane a little bit stiffer. There are sugar molecules or proteins modified by sugar molecules that stick up into the cytosol, I mean up into the extracellular space, and these can be used as antigens as well. They'll have a special shape, right? And all your cells will have just that specially shaped surface, all these different kinds of elements on there. So this is the phospholipid bilayer, or the cell membrane. So people might not recognize that as an organelle, but that actually might be the most important organelle in your body because it defines where all the living processes are going to take place. All right, let's look at another organelle. And maybe I'll go back to that previous slide. All right, here's that plasma membrane that we talked about. And I see a bunch of folds of membranes. All right, so it's just membranes folded on top of membranes. And when you look at these membranes, do you see anything else besides the folds? I see these little dots. Some of you know what those are. Those are what we call ribosomes. That's an organelle, and it's associated with these folding membranes. These folding membranes are what we call endoplasmic reticulum. That's Latin, I think, for membranes folded all up on each other. Right. And these ribosomes are responsible for protein synthesis. That is their job. So all of these organelles that we see right here, I want you to have at least a little bullet point of what it does inside the cell. So you learn some anatomy, and you'll also learn a little bit about physiology. So if I ask, what's the function of a ribosome, you're just going to say protein synthesis, right? Nice and easy like that. You don't have to know more about protein synthesis other than that. But we'll learn a little bit more later on in the class. So that's what we call rough endoplasmic reticulum because it looks like sandpaper because it has ribosomes. So this is rough endoplasmic reticulum. What is its job? It always has ribosomes attached to it. Its job is to make proteins because it has ribosomes. And when it makes a protein, the proteins end up inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum, inside this membrane system. I see other ribosomes that are floating around in the cytosol. I see some here, here, and here. What's the job of this ribosome right here? Where I have the cursor. What's the job of this ribosome? Yeah, protein synthesis. That's what a ribosome does. But now that protein is inside the cell in the cytosol. It's not inside the rough endoplasmic reticulum. And that's a huge difference, right? Because it's in two different structural parts of the cell, has two different functions. And I'll describe that to you in just a second after we go over some of these organelles. Okay, rough ER, what's the function of rough ER? Protein synthesis. Yeah, protein synthesis. Okay, I see another membrane system over here. These are stacks of membranes. Rough endoplasmic reticulum are kind of bent around the shape of the nucleus. What about this structure here? We call this a Golgi body. It's kind of bent the other way around. It's bent away from the nucleus. It's pointing. The ends are pointing more toward the plasma membrane. And this is the Golgi body. Golgi body gets proteins from rough endoplasmic reticulum. And I can see some of these proteins inside the Golgi body. And the Golgi body then can modify these proteins. It can add a sugar molecule or snip off a little piece of a protein. What's a building block of a protein? Everybody probably knows. Amino acid. Yeah, amino acid is a building block of a protein. Maybe it adds some amino acids or takes off some amino acids. Maybe it adds it to a lipid molecule or a sugar molecule. So the job of Golgi body is what we call modification. It changes the structure of those molecules that came from the rough ER. So what's it doing to those molecules that come from rough ER? It's changing their function because it's changing their shape. So Golgi body is pretty important. The other thing it does is that these modified proteins end up in this structure, just a spherical structure that we call a vesicle, and it has a membrane. That membrane is almost exactly the same as the cell membrane. Maybe it doesn't have quite the same proteins in it, but it still has a phospholipid bilayer for sure. And it can move over to the plasma membrane. And since these two membranes, the membrane of the vesicle, membrane of the cell, are almost identical, they can fuse together very easily. Right? When they touch each other, they can just fuse together. Have you ever had a little bottle with some soap in it and a little hoop that you could put inside the bottle, take it out, I should get some, right? And then wave it around in the air, and what do you get? You get these bubbles that kind of float down. They can't stay suspended because they don't have an engine or anything, but they kind of float around. Most of the time, when they float around and touch each other, they pop. But every once in a while, when they touch each other, what happens? They form a bigger bubble because the film that's making the bubble is the same on those two. It's just that soapy solution, right? So if the membrane is the same, then it can fuse together very nicely, very easily. And then all of the stuff that was inside this vesicle, guess where it goes? Outside the cell. Right, so proteins that are made by ribosomes on rough endoplasmic reticulum have a fate of leaving the cell. We call that secretion. So their fate is to be released from the cell, or they stay inside this vesicle, but these products never float around inside the cytosol like this. But you still can have proteins in the cytosol. Why? Because here are ribosomes that aren't attached to endoplasmic reticulum. These ribosomes make proteins that belong in the cytoplasm or the cytosol. And these can never be secreted from the cell. So rough ER makes something that contributes to the secretory pathway. These ribosomes just make something that stays inside the cell. There's another kind of membrane system besides this one that modifies and packages, and this one over here that produces proteins. We have one right here. And sometimes it looks a lot like rough endoplasmic reticulum, but it's always going to be, does it look rough? No rough, because no ribosomes. So we call that smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So can smooth endoplasmic reticulum make a protein? Oh, this would be a good test question. Can smooth ER make proteins? No, because why? No ribosomes in there, right? So if you know those functions, then you're really good. But it does synthesize. It does make something. It makes lipids. It makes fats. All right, so rough ER for protein synthesis, smooth ER for lipid synthesis, and even modification. Okay, what are these membranes made of, like the plasma membrane? Can you give me, how would you think about a membrane? How about the simple description of a cell membrane? The simple description would be, the simple name for a membrane would be phospholipid bilayer, right? The simple description, phospholipid bilayer, just those two layers. And when you hear phospholipid, what kind of molecule is it? Phospholipid. Yeah, you hear the lipid part, and those phospholipids that make membranes are made by smooth endoplasmic reticulum. So it's busy making all those little building blocks of these membranes right here. Okay. So big difference between smooth and rough ER. Jot this down. I don't think your book makes a big deal of it. Sometimes it might be a big deal, huge deal when you get to physiology. Smooth endoplasmic reticulum has another function in that it can store calcium. It can be a site for storing calcium. So lipid synthesis and storing calcium. And that calcium can be used as a very important signal for a whole bunch of things. And your body can get calcium right here. Where else can your body get calcium from? Where else do you have calcium? Oh, you guys know this. Are you awake or are you shy? Oh, you're shy. Bones, right? Bones have a lot of calcium. And you can store calcium in bones, but you don't want to take a lot of calcium out of bones if other parts of your body need it, because why? Then they get weak. They can even fracture, right? If it happens too much, we call that osteoporosis. So the smooth ER can store calcium, and that helps spare bones to some degree. All right, another organelle. Kind of looks like a little bean, and it has two membranes. It has an outer membrane and an inner membrane. And this is an organelle that looks a whole lot like a bacteria. Bacteria look almost exactly like this. And the nucleus contains genetic material for us, but you know what? This mitochondria has a chromosome as well. It has genetic material. And it has a cell membrane. I see a membrane around it, and it has cytosol, material inside itself, inside the mitochondria. So what do we call something that has genetic material, cell membrane, and cytoplasm? A cell, yeah, a living unit. So as a matter of fact, and this is a well-accepted theory by everybody, this right here really looks like a bacteria. It's a living cell that's living inside your cells. And we know that many millions of years ago, there was a cell that didn't have mitochondria that got infected by mitochondria, and then there was an agreement between the mitochondria so that it wouldn't be killed by the cell, okay? And then the mitochondria had to do something for the cell, right? So the cell provides something for the mitochondria. Mitochondria provides something for the cell. Does anybody know what that's called? That's a scientific kind of word. That's a symbiosis, right? So that relationship is what we call a symbiosis. And what the cell provides is protection, right? So it helps protect this mitochondria from being lysed, being broken down by viruses, right? It also gives this mitochondria the building blocks of something that it wants to make, right? So that's what the mitochondria gets out of the deal. What does the cell, what do we get from this mitochondria right here? The reason why we don't ever want to get rid of them.
Energy.
Yeah, energy in the form that the cell can use, that's called ATP. Right, so probably the most important function of this mitochondria is to produce ATP, or ATP synthesis. That's why some textbooks call this the powerhouse of the cell. I don't know if I really ever liked that term, but you can kind of see where it describes what's happening here. All right, that theory that describes how this mitochondria exists in us, that's called the endosymbiont theory. Endo meaning inside something, and symbiont because it has a special relationship with the cells. And today, our cells cannot exist without mitochondria because we've evolved together so precisely, and these mitochondria can't exist without the cell. So we actually now think of this whole thing as a living unit, but you should be aware that that endosymbiont relationship has really taken place already. So you have a lot of company inside you, and they're doing good things. All right, another membrane-bound, another organelle that has a membrane around it is this sphere over here, sort of like this one. It could actually be this one if it's modified just right. It's called a lysosome, and a lysosome contains an enzyme. It is called lysozyme. Hopefully, I think I have that on the slide someplace. Maybe, no, I don't. You got to fill that in. Lysozyme. Lysozyme is an enzyme, and it's a special enzyme that can digest, right? It will break other big molecules down into smaller ones. We call that lysis. When we break something apart, we call that lysis, and that's where this lyso comes from. And zome has to do with this little particle, the spherical particle inside the cell. So you have digestive enzymes. We call this an intracellular digestive system. They can digest proteins down to amino acids, for instance. All right, that's the lysosome. And how stable would you like these lysosomes to be? Since they have digestive enzymes, would it be okay with you if they start to break apart? No, because what happens then? You have those digestive enzymes running around everywhere inside the cell, digesting the cell from the inside. That's not ever good for the cell. The cell's going to die when that happens. Right? And in order for these lysosomes to be nice and stable, sometimes steroids like cortisone, right, will help stabilize membranes because it's an important part of a membrane, right? Cholesterol. Cortisone is sort of like cholesterol in a way. So now we know that when somebody's having a heart attack, not only do we have to treat them for their heart attack, but we should give them something that stabilizes these lysosomes everywhere in their heart, so their heart doesn't get digested from the inside. Right? That's sort of recent knowledge, not too recent. So that's the job of a lysosome. So one word. No, two words. Sorry. The job of a lysosome is, it is a intracellular digestive system. Oh, my goodness. It's three words. Okay. So for digestion. There can be other vesicles inside the cell. And it's not labeled here. Do I have it on the slide? I might not even have it on the slide, but I'll talk about it a little bit. It could be a peroxisome. A peroxisome contains another enzyme called peroxidase. Right? A lysosome contains lysozyme. Peroxisome contains a peroxidase. And a peroxidase is pretty important because it can break down harmful chemicals that are inside your body that are produced, unfortunately, by some other processes. Right? It's like an antioxidant. right? So a peroxidase will work on molecules that have been damaged by oxygen. So oxygen is really a radical molecule to have. It's very active. And a peroxisome will help control some of the products that oxygen is involved in. Okay, so those are some vesicles inside the cell for digestion, right? For lysosome. And detoxification would be a good term for a peroxisome. Detoxification. All right, what are some other things? Well, we talked about mitochondria. I see centrioles right here. They're made up of little tubes called microtubules, a special arrangement that form this barrel-shaped structure. And next to it is going to be another one that's made up of microtubules, kind of in a arranged perpendicular to the first one. This is what we call a centrosome complex. And it has these two centrioles that make it up. These centrioles will control the microtubules that we see everywhere inside the cell. So they're the coordination center. And these other microtubules can determine the shape of the cell, because it can push and pull on the cell membrane. And so it can make the cell flat, can make it look like a square, can make it look like a column. That's the job of the centriole. The other thing that the centriole does when it controls these microtubules, all of these microtubules are like roadways or a railway system inside the car. So something can hop onto a microtubule and the microtubule will transport it to a different location within inside the cell, wherever it belongs. And so you should think of the microtubule as being a monorail. That's the best way to think of it, a monorail. Have you ever seen a monorail? No? No one's seen one? If you wanted to see one, where would you go? Yeah, Disneyland has them. As a matter of fact, you don't even have to go in. You can just go to the parking lot and see them if you want to. Okay? So that's what these microtubules do. All right, what other kind of organelles do I see right here? All right, cilia, flagella, microvilli are not on this slide, unfortunately. So I'm going to have to describe what they are. You might have a picture in your mind of what they are. Maybe I'll try to find one over the weekend and bring it in. But these are surface specializations or modifications of the surface on the plasma membrane so that these things stick out. These flagella stick out away from the cell. And, what's the function? Well, what's the function of these microtubules here? If you're going to write it down in just one word. Yeah, transportation is really nice. Transportation. Okay, that's a really nice big concept. Maybe a more general concept would be motility. Let's say motility. That just means what? Moving around. Okay, sessile is the opposite. Sessile is not moving around. Motile is being able to move around. So what kind of organism are you? Are you a sessile organism or motile? Depends on what time of day. Right, okay, so that's the difference. And the function of these projections, at least the flagellum, I have this down over here, a flagellum is important for motility because these microtubules project up into the flagellum and it causes the flagellum to flail around or whip, and when it whips around, it propels, like acts like a little propeller and it moves the cell around, it can swim around. There's only one kind of cell in the human body that still can do that, kind of a special cell, and that is a sperm. Okay? Women have the information in their nuclei to produce flagella, but it's never activated. So women don't have any cells with a flagellum. Rats. You guys are left out. Okay? But you're going to learn that you have more things than males do, so don't feel bad. All right. So that is for motility, for sperm cells. Cilia is like a flagellum. It has microtubules that project up into it, but they're a lot shorter. They're maybe only 10% the length, maybe even less than 10% the length of a flagellum. But the function there, did we define what the function of a flagellum is? Only in passing. I like motility. Yeah, motility, right? A sperm is not sessile. It is motile. All right. And the cilia has those microtubules in it that allow the cilia to move. So their function is motility. There are some cells that use cilia, right? Hundreds of them on the cell surface to move around inside the body. We have a lot of ciliated cells, but it's But it's not for moving the cell around, it's for moving the material that's on top of the cell. It can cause that material to be swept or to flow over the top of the cell, and the cell doesn't have to move around. Right? The material comes to it. So those are what we call cilia. We'll look at those in lab next week. Oh, we could. I'll try to find some flagella next week, too. I've never shown that in lab. Remind me. All right, and the microvilli, what does micro mean? Big or like really small? Really small. So microvilli are similar to a flagellum and a cilium, but they're extremely small. They're even a lot smaller. And their job is not motility. They are there because they act like folds on the surface of a membrane. Maybe you've looked at a filter sometime in your life and you see that a filter is all folded up. Take a filter apart maybe for your furnace or something. And what those folds do, it means that you have a filter that's maybe a foot by a foot wide, right? But if you unfold the folds, what happens to that foot by foot wide structure if you unfold it? It gets bigger, right, in two dimensions. So that's the job of those microvilli. It increases the surface area for absorption. Microvilli absorption. You want to just say absorption. So where would you think you might have some microvilli? Yeah, intestines, digestive tract, right? Because that's where you absorb stuff. Right on. Okay, so cilia, flagella, motility, microvilli, absorption. Because it increases the surface area. That's pretty good with all of these different organelles. We got some more structures. We've got some structures inside the nucleus. Here's the nucleolus. This is the active part of the nucleus. It's making materials that will make a ribosome, right? And those are called nucleic acids. So this nucleolus is joining nucleic acids together, and it can make ribosomes. That's its job. And what's the function of this ribosome? Protein synthesis, right? So whenever you see this nucleolus right here, now you should know that this cell is being asked to produce proteins, right? Whenever you see this nucleolus. The DNA is scattered out everywhere inside the nucleus. You see that the nucleus has two membranes around it, right? So it has a double membrane system, very difficult to get across. So there are pores, right? Nuclear pores that allow small molecules to move across. And sometimes big molecules, they're too big to go through these pores. They have to have some kind of active mechanism that transports them. So remember, the fluid mosaic model has to be used to describe this membrane because it has pores, but also transporters that can move big molecules across the membrane. So a transporter was on that list when we talked about proteins that can be embedded in a cell membrane. Okay, what else? Nuclear pores, nucleolus, chromosomes. Oh yeah, so we have chromosomes. Inside this nucleus, they're made out of genetic material, nucleic acids, and maybe a good way to think of that is DNA. This is a good term we could use for that kind of genetic material. The building block of DNA is a nucleic acid. The building block of protein is amino acid. The building block of a triglyceride is a fatty acid. Right? So I think that won't be too hard to remember. Fatty acid for triglyceride, maybe you had your triglyceride measured in your blood at some point in time, triglyceride. What's the building block of protein? Amino acid. What's the building block of a lipid or a triglyceride? Fatty acid, yeah. Okay, that's really good to know. We don't get into too much molecular stuff in class, but just a little bit. And so here we have these, the DNA strand, and that all these DNA strands right here contain the blueprint on how to build this cell. It's the blueprint, like if you have a building, you're going to build a building, you need a blueprint. Here's the blueprint for building the cell, and when the cell runs out of some things that it requires, well, it can be remade because that information is stored inside the nucleus, right? It can still get those instructions to rebuild something that has broken down. All right, so you see all of these organelles inside the cell. This is a really nice modern cell in terms of evolution because it has all these special little compartments all over the place. But I guess I want you to understand the big picture. Why the heck do we have all these different compartments, all these different organelles inside the cell. Why can't we just get rid of all these membranes around these things? What's the function of organelles? We don't even talk about this so much in a biology class, but it's really simple understanding. Okay, here we have a building, right? Big, huge building. And this building is broken up into rooms. Why does it have rooms? How come it's not just one big room? Why is it not just one big room? Same question is, how come the cell has organelles? So think of an organelle as a room. Why are there rooms inside this building? Yeah, to separate different kinds of functions. I was always kind of disappointed with that because I thought if this building was one big room, right, I could listen to a physics lecture, I could listen to anatomy lecture, a micro lecture, a physiology lecture, maybe a couple math lectures at the same time, and I could get, you know, a degree in one semester. That would be really cool. You know, but when I tell people that, they just laugh. Now, why is that? Because when you have an anatomy instructor instructing anatomy and a physiology instructor, they interfere with each other, right? So the job of all these organelles is to provide a special place to perform their function, but the special place also means that it cannot interfere with other important functions that are happening inside the cell, right? So it allows a lot of functions to take place without interaction, without interruption, okay, without disrupting these other kinds of functions. That's why they're in the cell. Okay, that's kind of good to know. Okay, let's talk about movement across the plasma membrane. What's the simple way to think about that plasma membrane once again? Phospholipid bilayer, right? And the key term right there is lipid. So here is a lipid, and does a lipid dissolve in water? No, it doesn't, right? It separates itself really nice. Just automatically it does, just by the physical properties. And water, right, separates itself from these lipids in here. So these membranes can actually self-assemble. They just kind of build themselves, which then means water cannot get across this membrane unless it has a special channel to do so. What kind of things can dissolve in water that you're aware of? How about salt? Take a salt shaker, put it in some water, stir it just a little bit, what happens? Dissolves right in, okay? So salt and sugar is another really good example. You can put a lot of sugar in water, it will dissolve right in. So sugar and table salt, and what makes table salt is sodium and potassium. Those molecules can't get across the cell membrane because the cell membrane is what? It is not water, it is lipid. So those things, if they're on the outside, they're stuck on the outside. If they're on the inside, they're stuck on the inside, unless there is a channel across the membrane. And molecules can move around all by themselves under a certain circumstance, right? And that circumstance is by a difference in concentration. We call that diffusion. Molecules can diffuse. So if I have a perfume bottle right here, and there's no perfume in the air, can you smell perfume if there's no perfume molecules in the air? Can you smell perfume? You can read the label. You can maybe imagine what it smells like, but you can't smell it. Right? If I take the top off of the perfume bottle, some of those molecules will evaporate into the air, and they will start to move around. And guess who will smell it first? People in the front row, right? Then people in the second, all the way to the back, but I have to keep the bottle open for a long period of time for that to happen. So perfume in the bottle is a high concentration. Perfume in the room is a low concentration. So a molecule can diffuse from high concentration to low concentration. That's the only way it can move, by diffusion. It has to go from high to low. Right? And if I leave this perfume bottle open, here's a pretty good test. Here's the next step you could take with that concept. If I leave this perfume bottle open during spring break, okay, and we come back in the room, right, and what has happened to that perfume? Okay, it has moved throughout the whole room. So you can smell it in the back, and you can smell it to the same intensity in the front of the room, right, because it had time to diffuse everywhere so that the concentration is the same everywhere inside the room. And if the concentration is the same inside the room after a long period of time, is there diffusion taking place anymore? You still have molecules that are dissolved in the air. And the answer is there is no diffusion. Diffusion stops when the concentration gradient stays the same or becomes the same. I mean, there might be one molecule that moves to the back, but that also means what? One molecule in the back moves to the front. So they can still move around a little bit, but there's no net exchange taking place. Okay, so that happens automatically. We didn't need to turn on a fan, motor, nothing. It just happens automatically. That's what we call a passive process. Diffusion is a passive process, does not require energy. There are other kinds of processes that need energy in order to move molecules around. Those we don't call passive. We want to call those active transport mechanisms. And the energy that is used most of the time, almost 100% of the time, I can't even think of an exception to the rule, but I'm sure there is. What do you think is the energy molecule that allows for active transport? ATP. Where do you get ATP from? Mitochondria. Yeah, so mitochondria, important for helping move things across the cell membrane that need help, that have to be transported actively. All right, so passive transport processes do not require energy, that like we see on the text slide over here. Things have to go only from high concentration to low. They can't go from low to high. Can't go low to high, can only go from high to low. And here we have a couple different kinds of diffusion. Simple diffusion is what we just talked about. Then here is another one called osmosis. That's a form of diffusion. All right, so is osmosis active or passive? Does osmosis need ATP? No, it's a passive process. All right, and since it's a passive process, which way do molecules diffuse? Only from high to low. So indeed, osmosis is diffusion. Okay, but it's special because we have to put these other qualifications on it. It's the diffusion of a water molecule, and it could only be a water molecule. And water is the solvent that we're dissolved in. So the most general rule is that it's the movement of that solvent molecule in us, that's water, right, down a concentration gradient, because it can only move from high to low because that's a passive process. And then one last thing. Right, water is going to move from high concentration to low without any expenditure of energy across a membrane. And we're loaded with membranes, like a cell membrane, mitochondrial membrane. Right, so those are the three things that osmosis has to be. Number one, it is diffusion, which means high to low only. The second thing is that it's only the solvent molecule, which for us means water. And the third criteria is that water has to move across a membrane. If you meet all those three criteria, then we can call that osmosis, whether it is a living system or not. We do osmosis experiments all the time in physiology and other kinds of classes. All right. So what else do we need besides water to do an osmosis experiment in lab? What else do we need? Do we need energy? Do we need ATP? No. No. What do we need? A concentration gradient of something. We'll mix up a solution really high in sugar in one part, low in sugar in the other, then sugar is going to want to go from high concentration to low, and maybe across the membrane if it's a special kind of membrane. And that special membrane is what we call a semi-permeable membrane. Semi-permeable means selectively permeable. It can only allow certain things to go across, not everything. Right? If it allows everything to move across, then it's not really a membrane. So it's kind of a misnomer to say semi-permeable membrane, but if a membrane allows everything to go through, it's not really a membrane, right? Selectively permeable membrane. All right, so remember, osmosis, passive. Active transport requires energy. Things can go from low concentration to high, right? So for instance, I have that perfume bottle again, and all the perfume has dissolved out, has evaporated out, fills the room, can smell perfume all over the place. Is it possible to get all that perfume back and put it in the bottle? Won't happen automatically, but how did all that perfume get in the bottle in the first place? Somebody had a machine that took those perfume molecules, right, and put them in that bottle, and that required energy to do that. That would be an active process putting all of that perfume in, right, and that means that that perfume molecules would go from low to high concentration, really high concentration inside the bottle. It can happen, but it requires energy, and the energy that's used in our body is ATP, We don't have any organelles that have perfume bottles with perfume in it, but that's a pretty good example to think about. All right, so ATP can release energy. Energy is stored in the form of a chemical bond, and when a chemical bond is broken, it releases that energy. That energy can be used to do other things. And it's really hard to understand what energy is. It is a real thing, but you can't weigh it, you can't really see it, can't smell it. So it's really good to have some idea of what energy is. Does anybody know what energy is? Anybody take a physics class, energy? Help me out, because it was a long Christmas break. Oh, it's coming back to me. I remember what it is. Who knows? Who knows what energy is? It's the ability to do work. Okay? Ability to do work. So falling down the stairs, not work. Walking up the stairs, work. What does it require? Energy. Okay? Okay. Perfume molecules evaporating from a perfume bottle. Okay? Does it require energy? No. There's no work being done. Grabbing all those perfume molecules, putting it back in the bottle, does that work? Yeah. Requires energy, right? Active process. All right, let's look at ATP. So here's ATP, and that stands for adenosine triphosphate. It's probably not too important that you know that. You don't have to know the chemical formula for ATP, but this P right here stands for phosphorus, right? And this is adenosine triphosphate. So you could tell me how many phosphates are in adenosine triphosphate? Yeah, there are three, okay? And it's the bonds between those phosphorus atoms that are really strong and release a lot of energy when they break. When one of those bonds break, you get adenosine diphosphate, which means what? How many phosphates? Just two phosphates. That means one phosphate has jumped off of this molecule, right? And here I have it right here. I call that inorganic phosphate because it's more than just a phosphorus atom. There's some other things attached to it. So inorganic phosphate. And we have to have the same energy on either side of this equation. Energy can either be created or destroyed. It can just change form from one form to another. So we have to have the same energy over here. So if we had an energy in the chemical bond between this phosphate and ADP and this phosphate that's just floating out here in solution, and we break that bond, it's got to go somewhere, so I put it in the equation. So when ATP is broken down, you get ADP, inorganic phosphate, plus the ability to run up the stairs, or energy, right? You have the ability to do work. Okay, so that's what we call hydrolysis of ATP. Lysis, what does lysis mean once again? Breaking down, yeah. Just think of a scissors chopping something apart. All right, so active processes require some of these things. Molecular transport. For instance, we looked at that already over here. Okay, so here we have some particles that are inside the cell, inside this vesicle, and then the vesicle moves over to the cell membrane, releases the particles into this extracellular fluid. These are macromolecules that couldn't get across the membrane, and it requires ATP to move this vesicle around. It required a lot of ATP to get all these protein molecules inside this vesicle. You could think of this as, right, the perfume bottle and all those molecules in there is the perfume. So it took energy to concentrate all of those molecules in there, and then the cell's going to move it around. So that's an active transport process requiring energy or ATP. That is molecular transport. And the cell can even move big particles around from one side of the membrane to the other using a vesicle here. So the size of the molecule hardly matters. Right, because there's going to be a big space that opens up, so even huge, big macromolecules can move across the cell membrane. Okay. There are three kinds of macromolecular transport. Let me look at my whole series of slides that I can look at. Macromolecular transport. Here's a nice zoomed-in region. Here we have the nucleus over here. Here we have, what does this look like? Rough endoplasmic reticulum. What's attached to this membrane? Yeah, ribosomes. So function of rough ER is protein synthesis. Those proteins end up inside the rough ER, like where I have the cursor right now, moves through these membranes, comes over here, and then the membrane forms a little pocket, and those proteins are now caught in that pocket. that pocket kind of buds away, pinches off from the rough endoplasmic reticulum, becoming, what does it become when this tip of a endoplasmic reticulum pinches off and becomes a vesicle? And that vesicle has different names depending on what kind of proteins are inside of it, right? It could be a lysosome, could be a peroxisome, depending whether it has digestive enzymes or a peroxidase. And then it moves over to the Golgi. Doesn't have to, but a lot of times it moves over to the Golgi. Ah, look over here. It has moved over, has fused to the membrane. Now these proteins end up inside the Golgi body. And what is the Golgi body going to do? These things don't go there for no reason because, I'll give you a hint, it takes energy to get over there. So what's going to happen to them in the Golgi? Yeah, modification. They're going to be conjugated with something, maybe a sugar molecule or a lipid, for instance. Right? It modifies that protein as it moves through this system, gets to the end of that Golgi body, and again, it gets put into this little bulge that pinches away from the Golgi body, and then now you're in another vesicle, and the cell can move this vesicle around, maybe move it over to the cell membrane in this particular case, and these membranes will fuse together, so whatever in this vesicle, which was in the Golgi, which was in the rough endoplasmic reticulum, ends up where? Outside the cell. That's what we call secretion. Right? And when that happens, when something leaves the cell, we call that exocytosis. Exo, meaning leaving. Exit sign, right there. There's an answer key right there for exocytosis. Okay, that's pretty handy. And that just does not happen automatically, right? That requires energy. And so you can imagine what molecule is being used up? ATP. And ATP is being converted from ATP to ADP and inorganic phosphate, and there's not as much energy in ADP as there is ATP. So if you can't make ATP, you're going to run out of energy. And your cells can't perform all these nifty kind of functions. There are some organs in our body. I want to tell you how important ATP is, to give you a little handle to understand how important ATP is in our body. Well, I want to tell you how it's made. Okay. What is this guy right here? Mitochondria, we zoomed in, mitochondria, it makes ATP for us, but it needs oxygen to do that. It needs oxygen all the time. And where does it get oxygen from? We feed it oxygen all the time. That's part of the agreement that we have with mitochondria. We give it oxygen and it can give us ATP back. We also have to give it some other molecules like glucose. There's energy in glucose that the mitochondria then can put into ATP. Right, so mitochondria need oxygen. How much ATP do we need from these mitochondria? I want to give you a ballpark figure for that. There are some people, I'm sure, that are CPR certified. And so if somebody's heart stops beating, you don't have blood going to the brain. And if you don't have blood going to the brain, there's no oxygen being delivered because there are special molecules in blood that are designed to deliver oxygen. Somebody's heart stops, no blood is going to the brain, no oxygen is going to the brain, your brain is going to stop functioning because it's going to run out of ATP. How soon does it run out of enough ATP that you lose consciousness? How many minutes, how many hours of consciousness do you have when blood stops going to the brain? Because your brain can't make ATP. These mitochondria say, can't do it, no oxygen. And the answer is about 2 seconds, 2 to 3 seconds. That's how important ATP is in the brain. All right? And if blood supply isn't restored to the brain and your brain can't make ATP, it's going to die. So when your heart stops, you lose consciousness after about 2 or 3 seconds because your brain has run out of ATP. Your brain is still using whatever ATP is there and then uses so much that the brain actually dies. What does die mean? Can you come back? No, it's like this irreversible process. At least in this class, we're going to think of it as irreversible. All right, brain death, you can't come back because your brain has run out of too much ATP. So from when the time you pass out to when your brain is actually dead is how long? 2 seconds for the first step. Second step, a little bit longer, 2 to 3 minutes. Okay, after 2 to 3 minutes, then you run out of ATP almost completely and the brain dies. Can't ever come back. Even if you give it ATP, it's too late. Right? So that's how sensitive your body is to ATP. You have seconds of life, right, if these mitochondria can't make it. They got to make it. They got to make a lot of ATP every day so that muscles can contract, so that we can think thoughts and control other things in our body. And so another good question would be, how much ATP do you need in a way that we can think about what a way of thinking about it? So I think about it in terms of weight. How much weight of ATP do we have to have? And what would your answer be, a lot or just a little? A lot. Okay, it is a lot. So a typical human being is about 70 kilograms. We're just going to define that. There might not be anybody 70 kilograms in here, but we're just going to say 70 kilograms. The amount of ATP that you need is 40 kilograms, more than half your body weight every day. All right, so that's a huge amount. You don't have to have a suitcase full of ATP because you can eat glucose and the mitochondria will produce that like suitcase of ATP for you. All right, so that's why we call this thing the powerhouse of the cell. Okay, there are two other kinds of macromolecular transport that need that ATP. And what is called, let me put this one away. If I can't, no, I can't. Okay, I got to go back. Got to go back here to where I was. Okay, so here we have a particle inside the cell that's leaving the cell. What do we call that process? Exocytosis, right? Leaving the cell. But the other process can take place as well. If it's a solid particle that is moving here in the extracellular fluid and it just happens to move into this vesicle or this little pouch inside the cell membrane and then it pinches off and the vesicle moves the other way into the cell, that particle that has been phagocytized, phagocytosis, is a way of moving material into the cell, the opposite direction of exocytosis. Phagocytosis can be big macromolecules or pieces of cells. Is phagocytosis. Right? Sometimes the cell wants to take in particles that are dissolved in the water solution around the cell. Right? So it's not a solid particle, it's in solution. When that happens, we call that pinocytosis. Pinocytosis, as opposed to phagocytosis. Phagocytosis means eating particles. The cell is eating large particles. Pinocytosis means cell drinking. It's bringing in fluid into the cell. So the fluid has maybe electrolytes or other things dissolved in it, but it's a solution, not a big particle that has precipitated out of solution. And in any case, it can go from a low concentration to a high concentration. What kind of process goes from low to high? Active transport, requiring ATP, right? And you need a lot of ATP? Yeah, you need... I would say a ton. We can say a ton, but not quite a ton. So you need a lot of ATP every single day. So 2 seconds, and then two to three seconds, 2 to 3 minutes, and then your brain actually dies as a result of that. Okay, so exocytosis you see right here. The opposite direction is, I didn't tell you what the opposite direction is. I gave you some specific examples, right? Leaving the cell is exocytosis. Entering is endocytosis. And how many forms of endocytosis do you know? Oh, that's a really good way. I need to modify this slide. What do you want to put in here? You want to put endocytosis in there. And how many classes of endocytosis are there? You can break it down into phagocytosis. Yeah, somebody said two. Phagocytosis and pinocytosis. So there are two. So phago and pinocytosis are examples of endocytosis. Okay? We get a little wordy. You're going to notice that in anatomy. Okay, here is a topic. Let's see, let me look at the time. What do we go to? 12:05? Something like that. Okay, I don't have very much time left, but I can introduce this slide. This is where we're going to start next time. Protein synthesis. All right, so what's the building block you need to make a protein? Amino acid. Where does it take place inside of a cell? On a ribosome. That's where proteins are made. Okay, but we're going to actually learn a little bit more about protein synthesis. And I can describe this first part right here, so don't make too much noise. This is what we call the central dogma in biology. A dogma is something that you should just accept to be true, never think about, never question, and just live with it, right? Just, it's such an important principle, so obvious that you should never question that. So here's the central dogma in biology. Okay, we have information that is stored in DNA inside your nucleus. It can be converted into information in RNA, which leaves the nucleus, and then the information in RNA can be converted into a protein. So where does the information for building this protein come from originally? From DNA inside the nucleus. All right, so when you see this process, protein synthesis, how many steps do you see? And another way of asking that, how many arrows do you see? You see two. Yep, it's got two steps. Right. And what about the process? Can it go backwards? Nope. Look at those arrows. Not double-ended arrow, single-ended arrow. Right. So DNA determines, right, the proteins that your body can make. The proteins that are in your body cannot change your DNA, cannot change your chromosomes. And I find that to be really, really good. I like that a lot. Because when you go home and have a chicken dinner tonight, you don't have to worry about waking up with feathers. Right, those proteins can never change who you are in to a large degree. All right, so that's what I want you to know about protein synthesis for today. Two steps. All right, part of it is in the nucleus, part of it is in the cytosol, maybe requiring ribosomes, and we're going to look at this in a little more detail, and it's a one-way street only, one-way street. Okay, so that's it for today. I didn't have any sign-in sheets this week. Next week I'll start having sign-in sheets when the rosters have stabilized. I'll know who's in class, who's not in class. Then I'll pass it around. So you're free to go. Have a nice weekend. Do we have class on Monday? Yeah, Monday's not a holiday, so be sure to come back Monday.